MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, a new study shows sexual predators are less likely to reoffend than other criminals. But statistics don't tell the whole story.
Turks react angrily to the weekend bombings of two synagogues.
There have been analogies made with the September 11th attacks on the U.S., saying that this is our September 11th. And people are concerned that there may be additional attacks sometime in the near future.
Also, what killed three people and made hundreds sick at a restaurant outside of Pittsburgh? A culinary detective case may point to contaminated scallions.
These stories and a guilty verdict in the Maryland sniper case, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Washington, D.C. area sniper suspect John Allen Mohammed has been convicted of two counts of capital murder in connection with one of the sniper killings last fall. He was also convicted of two lesser criminal counts. The verdict was announced in Virginia Beach, Virginia, just moments ago. The jury reached the decision after only 6 hours of deliberation. The verdict came after 3 weeks of testimony in which a series of victims and other witnesses recalled the sense of terror that gripped the nation's capital during the sniper attacks last fall. The verdict means that Mohammed faces a possible death sentence. The jury will now hear further testimony as the trial moves into a sentencing phase. Earlier today, while the jury was out of the courtroom, prosecutors disclosed that Mohammed tried to escape last spring from a jail in Virginia. The judge in the case ruled that if Mohammed was convicted, that information could be presented to the jury in the sentencing phase. At the trial of the other Cypress suspect, Lee Boyd Malvo, prosecutors have begun calling witnesses to the stand in Chesapeake, Virginia. In other news today, California's governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger takes the oath of office in 2 hours in a low-key ceremony befitting that state's budget crisis. John Myers of member station KQED has more.
A crowd of almost 10,000 is expected on the grounds of California's state capitol as Arnold Schwarzenegger becomes the state's 38th governor, replacing recalled chief executive Gray Davis. Hundreds of reporters from around the world will be on hand, as will be a number of Hollywood celebrities. But Governor-elect Schwarzenegger maintains he will get straight to work on his first day in office. That work is expected to include a repeal of the controversial increase in California's car tax, an issue that sparked many voters to remove Gray Davis from office last month. Schwarzenegger is also expected to call California's legislature into a special session to deal with the state's mounting financial problems. The incoming governor has less than 2 months to prepare a budget for the coming fiscal year. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
Officials in Turkey say Al-Qaeda is believed to be responsible for the weekend suicide bombings of two synagogues. Those attacks claimed the lives of 23 people. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that Turkish intelligence sources indicate that Al-Qaeda was involved in Saturday's double suicide bombing. Istanbul police say they have found a photograph of one of the suicide bombers taken shortly before he detonated his truck bomb. The photo came from a security camera operating in the street of one of the attacked synagogues. The Istanbul governor also said that a number of people had been detained in relation to the attacks, but gave no further information. Today saw the first funeral of those killed in the bombings, a policeman who was protecting one of the synagogues. Prime Minister Erdogan was in attendance. Hundreds of people in Istanbul marched for peace, ending their protests at one of the attacked synagogues. For NPR News, I'm Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stock prices are sagging today, led by a more than 1% decline in the Nasdaq Composite Index. Analysts say the bombings at the two synagogues in Turkey over the weekend and warnings of further such attacks have worried some investors. Airline shares in particular are down today. The Travelers Insurance firm is merging with the St. Paul companies to form the nation's second largest commercial insurer. The deal is worth about $16 billion. From member station WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut, John Dankosky reports.
The new company will be known as the St. Paul Travelers Companies, with total assets of $107 billion. While the corporate headquarters will be in Minnesota, its commercial and personal business lines will be consolidated under the Travelers brand and will be based in Hartford. The merger faces regulatory approval, but is expected to close in the second quarter of 2004. St. Paul's officials say the merger expands their product base and gives the company greater geographic reach. Travelers officials say no layoffs are planned, and employment in Connecticut could even grow. Jay Fishman, St. Paul's chairman and CEO, will become chief executive of the new company, with Robert Lipp of Travelers taking over as chairman. That arrangement will last until 2006, when Fishman is expected to take over both roles. For NPR News, I'm John Dankosky in Hartford.
New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer says more cases stemming from the mutual fund trading scandal are, in his words, reasonably imminent. A number of firms and individuals have already been the subject of enforcement actions. Recapping our top story, Washington, D.C. area sniper suspect John Allen Muhammad has been found guilty of two capital murder charges in connection with one of the sniper shootings last fall. The verdict means that he now faces a possible death sentence. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now. The jury in the Virginia Beach case of accused sniper John Allen Muhammad has returned a verdict, guilty on all four counts. We'll have more in a moment, but first.
Turning overseas, Robin, how to confront violence and the threat of no end to violence in Iraq. On Saturday, two Black Hawk helicopters collided in the country's north, possibly after being hit by or trying to elude ground fire. 17 American soldiers died. On Sunday, an Arab television station broadcast a new audio tape said to be the voice of Saddam Hussein, urging an escalation of rebel attacks. The U.S. continues to respond with greater displays of firepower than at any time since the war earlier this year, while the U.S. seems to be also intensifying its plans to hand over more power in Iraq to Iraqis. Joining me on the line is Wall Street Journal reporter Carla Ann Robbins. Welcome, Carla.
Thanks.
Carly, you note in today's article in the Wall Street Journal that it was just a few weeks ago that Ambassador Paul Bremer said that shortcutting the process of handing over power to Iraqis, Iraqification as we call it, would be dangerous. But now they seem to be on the path to do just that.
Well, I think they decided it was more dangerous, at least for the Americans, if they didn't hand over power. So they've really reversed course, which is a tough thing for an administration that never admits it's made a mistake. It's all a pretty big gamble, but their theory is that Iraqi public is sort of sitting on the fence and that by taking away the image of occupation, that people will sign on to the program of democracy and abandon the insurgents.
And yet it's all about elections eventually, isn't it? And in this 60% Shia country, wouldn't that mean that the Shias would take over and that would make the Kurds and the Sunnis, the minorities, very unhappy and maybe fracture the place more than it ever was before?
That's the thing about democracy. People get to choose. And one hopes that with time and rationality that everyone will be able to come up with a deal that they can live with. I mean, we've seen this split up, you know, end of authoritarian governments in the Balkans and former Soviet Union and lots of other places that lead to a great deal of disruption and violence and really awful things afterwards. But we also see it coming out the other end. Mm. Yeah, it's going to be a really bumpy ride for a while.
Carla, what's the sense in Washington as to whether this intensifying of Iraqification is being driven by political concerns with an election, of course, next year, or whether there really is a deep sense that Iraqis are ready for this?
I don't think that they are completely persuaded that the Iraqis are ready. At the same time, I'm sure that the notion that the clock is ticking to the election is driving part of it. But I also think that they've made a calculation that they believe makes sense, which is that give Iraqis more power and they may be more comfortable with the project that the U.S. is pushing. If there weren't an election, would they have done this fast? Probably not. But I think driving it even more is the fact that we have so many American fatalities every day. I think that's probably the immediate driving force. The fact that the elections are in November is certainly a close second.
From what you hear in Washington, what is the sense in the administration off the front pages and off what's said publicly about how Iraq is going?
Washington is a pretty big place, and there are a lot of different voices.
Yeah,
there's a considerable despair in the State Department about what's going on. There's considerable despair among certain ranks of, well, despair is perhaps too strong, among certain ranks of the military that feel that some people at the top of the Pentagon are underestimating the sophistication and the increasing spread of the insurgency. I think at the very top of the Pentagon, there's the feeling that they're not fighting major military battles, that there's, you know, maybe 5,000, the number up from what their original estimate was, of bad guys out there, and that they'll be able to choke it off. And their hope, once again, is by transferring sovereignty to the Iraqis, that the bad guys won't get any more support from the general population. It's not a happy place right now, either in Baghdad or here looking at it.
Carla Robbins is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She spoke to us from Washington. Thanks a lot, Carla.
Thanks, Bill.
Reaction continues in Turkey today to the weekend bombing of two synagogues in Istanbul. 24 people were killed, most of them Muslim. 7 were Turkish Jews. Hundreds of people were injured in the attacks. Bülent Alireza heads the Turkey project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Bülent.
Hi.
First of all, from your talks to people in Turkey, how are people reacting there?
There's a real sense of panic. And shock, frankly, that something like this could have happened in Turkey. There have been analogies made with the September 11th attacks on the U.S., saying that this is our September 11th. And people are concerned that there may be additional attacks sometime in the near future.
Well, remind us, the targets were synagogues, but Turkey and its Jews have an historically good relationship. Give us a quick sense of the size of the Jewish community and the relationship between Turkey and Israel.
It's a relatively small community. It's about 40,000 strong, and they trace their presence in Turkey back to the 16th century, when the Ottoman Empire opened its doors to the Sephardic Jews of Spain who were escaping the Spanish Inquisition. Turkey is the first country to have recognized the State of Israel when it was created. There is a close military cooperative relationship between Turkey and Israel, even though the vast majority of the population of Turkey, almost 98% or thereabouts, is Muslim.
Well, one of the temples attacked before in 1986 by Palestinians that time. Who is suspected of this attack, and what does that mean?
Well, the Al-Qaeda organization has claimed responsibility. Frankly, the Turks are working on the assumption that this was not a Turkish organization that did it, but an Islamic fundamentalist terrorist organization such as possibly Al-Qaeda with, again, possibly local help.
And what happens if that's true, Bülent? This government's been trying to convince people that it's more moderate, and it's been trying to distance itself from its Islamist past. So what happens if an Islamist organization in Turkey is tied to this attack?
Well, you're right. I mean, this government has been leaning over backwards to try and dispel the impression that its political enemies have that it's out to set up an Islamic State. So if it was to come out that Turkish Islamists of one shade or other were involved in this, it would certainly embarrass the government. The government is committed to fighting terrorism of all kinds. Nonetheless, if it were to be a Turkish Islamist organization that was somehow involved in this, it would make the job of the government that much more difficult.
Mm. In your view, Bülent, will this attack drive a wedge between the different factions in Turkey, or might this bring the country together?
The initial reaction is the latter. There is a wave of revulsion against an attack in the Muslim holy month of Ramadan that actually killed more Muslims than the supposed intended targets within the synagogues. But there are people in Turkey who would no doubt try to explain the event in terms of a reaction against Israel and its policies towards the Palestinians. And at some stage, you know, you may have divisions within the Turkish society after the attack. But for the moment, it has brought the community together.
Mm. Might there be enough anger at this attack and enough blame on the government for its Islamist past that, for instance, the more secular army might seek to either overthrow it or at least undermine it?
The relationship between the secular military establishment and the current government is a difficult one, and this has the potential to strain relations even further. If the government is perceived to be less than wholehearted in its fight against international terrorism that's now manifested itself in the middle of Istanbul,
clearly its enemies, including within the military establishment, might use that against the government. But, you know, an outright coup or a move against the government in the near future seems extremely unlikely.
Mm. Bulent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bulent Alireza heads the Turkey Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
Three people who died and 500 who fell ill from hepatitis A near Pittsburgh recently all have something in common. They ate at a Mexican restaurant called Chi-Chi's. This follows hepatitis A outbreaks in Tennessee, North Carolina, and Georgia last September. Joining us is Richard McGarvey of the Pennsylvania Department of Health. Welcome, Mr. McGarvey.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And thanks for joining us. Mr. McGarvey, three dead, 500 sick, and 11 Chi-Chi's employees tested positive for hepatitis A. Is that enough for you? How do you conduct an investigation like this? Is it enough to trace these cases back to this restaurant, Chi-Chi's?
Well, it's certainly the largest outbreak we've ever had here in Pennsylvania of hepatitis A. And certainly when the first cases started to come in almost 2 weeks ago now, all indications were Chi-Chi's, and certainly the store closed already, the particular restaurant. And so we hope the infections now, new infections, have also quit.
So how do you trace this back? What will you do now to try to prevent this from happening again?
Well, certainly what we're doing currently is interviewing all those people that have hepatitis A. By doing that, we hope to do interviews with them, find out when they ate at Chi-Chi's, what they ate. We're also interviewing people that ate at Chi-Chi's but didn't become ill. And by gathering all that information, really try to cross-reference it and come up with a source.
This is a chain, Chi-Chi's. People shouldn't necessarily be afraid of going into a Chi-Chi's to eat, right?
Well, we have no indication any other Chi-Chi's or restaurant, quite frankly, in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, has a problem with hepatitis A. It all seems to be focused right on this one restaurant.
Hmm. What is hepatitis A?
Hepatitis A is a viral disease. It's normally mild, but about a little under 1% of the cases, people will die. So it can be quite serious on the other end of the spectrum. So what we try to do is really get out there, find out anybody that could have been exposed and gave them a shot of what we call immune globulin that will help them or prevent them from becoming ill in the next coming weeks.
We also hear of hepatitis B and C. What's the difference?
Hepatitis A, of the three you just mentioned right there, is usually the less severe. It's what we call a self-limiting disease. It usually, after a number of couple weeks, 3-4 weeks, people recover without any long-term problems, whereas with hepatitis B and C, they certainly can be more chronic problems lasting over a much longer period of time.
Now, when you say exposed, is it from something they ate? We hear about green onions. Is that what you're looking at here?
Well, that's kind of been the tricky part of this whole investigation. We haven't been able to pin it down to one particular food item. Certainly green onions are one of the things we're looking at very closely because of their association with other outbreaks, but just haven't been able to pin it down.
Like the outbreaks we mentioned in September in three states?
Yes, those outbreaks are certainly ones that we're paying close attention to because of their similarities.
And would it be simply because the food wasn't cleaned properly?
Well, it's kind of hard to say without knowing the exact source. Certainly, hepatitis A has passed through what we call the fecal-oral route. In other words, fecal matter somehow from an infected person gets into the food chain. And, well, that can happen from a restaurant worker that's not using good hygiene, or it might happen before the food actually gets to the restaurant in the food production process somewhere.
Is there anything an average person can do who takes their family out to eat to prevent this sort of thing? It just seems like a very random unusual kind of event.
Yeah, keep in mind it is an unusual event. This is the largest outbreak of hepatitis A from a restaurant ever in Pennsylvania, and I do believe from the United States. So, you know, people should have confidence in the food chain and the restaurant going out to eat because this really is rare when it happens.
Do you think, though, you'll trace it back and figure out what happened here?
Certainly hope so. The problem with hepatitis A is the incubation period, or the time from when you are exposed to it when you get sick can be very long, anywhere from 15 to 50 days. So that makes it much more difficult to start tracing food back.
I see. So more cases could yet emerge.
Certainly more cases could yet emerge. At this point, you know, I don't think we've reached the end of that cycle yet.
Richard McGarvey is a spokesperson from the Pennsylvania Department of Health. Thanks, Mr. McGarvey.
Thank you for having me on.
Just ahead, a new study says convicted sex offenders are less likely than other criminals to reoffend after they serve their time. But what impact will that finding have?
And later in the show, two jazz legends, both bassists, will be joined by our jazz connoisseur, James Isaacs.
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's a commonly held view. Sex offenders should not be released from prison into the community after they've served their time because they're likely to reoffend. But new research says that belief may be wrong. The largest ever study of how inmates behave after they're released from prison shows that fewer sex offenders are arrested after release than are other inmates, which leads some victim advocates to worry that restrictions on former sex offenders could be relaxed. Erica Schmidt is a statistician with the Department of Justice and one of the authors of the study. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you.
Well, you know, this caught a lot of people's attention when they heard this news. Tell us, first of all, who was in the study? Who did the Justice Department study?
The Justice Department looked at 9,691 male sex offenders who were released from prison in 1994. They were released in 15 states throughout the U.S., which makes this the largest study ever done of sex offenders and their behaviors following release from prison.
Mm-hmm. And what did they find?
Well, the main finding was that 5% of sex offenders after release during that first three-year period, that 5% of sex offenders were rearrested for another sex crime. Which is probably the finding that everyone is sort of paying a lot of attention to.
But that 5% applied to sex crimes. What percentage of those over 9,000 men were rearrested for any crime?
43% were rearrested for any crime, which is fairly low compared to the overall rate of rearrest for prisoners released, when you take into consideration other violent offenders, property offenders, drug offenders, et cetera.
That number is 68% for other inmates. 68% of them are rearrested.
Correct.
Well, there are people who have been very critical of this headline because they say, well, the most serious rapists, sexual assaulters, a child molester, they don't get released into the population in the first place, so they're unable to add to that relatively low statistic of 5%.
You know, I've actually been hearing that, and it's my feeling that there's really no evidence to support that idea. Sex offenders in general serve about the same proportion of their sentence as other violent offenders. And when I say other violent offenders, I mean murderers, armed robbers. So there's really no reason to believe that sex offenders are being kept in prison longer.
Well, if they're not kept in prison, many states have laws that keep an eye on high-risk offenders, thinking of Megan's Law, so that people will know where they are. Doesn't that limit their ability to reoffend?
I'm not sure whether it limits their ability to reoffend, but it would increase the scrutiny that they're under. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably safe to say that they are surveilled at a higher rate than other offenders. But the thing to keep in mind is that the police know who they're looking for most of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they keep an eye on many of the offenders that are released back into the community, because we do know that one of the greatest predictors of recidivism and reoffending is past offending.
Well, and yet some are already saying, I'm looking at one Associated Press story that says that your numbers seem to dispute the notion that sex offenders are incorrigible. Critics of that conclusion would say even that 5% is too high a risk for society to take.
I would agree with that. I mean, one sex crime is one too many. When we think about all of the treatment options and all of the surveillance tools that we use with any type of offender, whether it's a sex offender or someone else, we obviously need to give offenders all the tools that they need to try to succeed once they're released, and also make sure that we're increasing public safety at the same time.
What is the Justice Department taking from this?
The component of the justice system that's most interested in this information is the FBI. They helped to fund this study, especially because they wanted information regarding offenders who crossed state lines and were rearrested outside the state that released them. Which is also something that the public is very interested in, I would assume. The FBI has been promoting the use by states of these different DNA databases so that offenders can be tracked. We have the genetic profile of released offenders. And we do know that about one out of every six of the arrests of sex offenders once they were released from prison did occur in a state outside of the one that released them.
What would you say, though, to people who are hearing about this study from the Justice Department and are worried that this might lead to sort of a relaxing of concerns about released child molesters, for instance?
I don't think that that's something that we're going to have to worry about. We leave it up to the the administrators of correctional facilities and parole agencies to know the offenders that they come across on a case-by-case basis. We know that offenders with longer criminal records are at a greater risk for reoffending, so there might be a need to have programs, whether in prison or once they're released, that help to target these higher-risk offenders to try to keep them from failing once they're released. We also know that the majority of the reoffending that occurred within that three-year period happened within that first year. And so, parole agencies might want to take note of that and see if perhaps they're seeing the same type of trend within their own specific local populations of offenders to see if they can come up with some programs that specifically target that time period.
So what do you read into this research, Erica? Do you think that, as some are saying, that this might sort of change our view of whether or not sex offenders can be rehabilitated?
I think what it says is that we really have to still do a lot more work in trying to figure out what our predictors of recidivism are. Right now, the best thing we have going for us in terms of research on sex offenders is we know that the longer the prior the criminal record, the more likely the sex offender is to reoffend once they're released. Unfortunately, a lot of the other predictors of recidivism for the general prison population once they're released, they aren't really very good predictors for sex offenders. Like, normally we see that the older the offender is when released, the less likely they are to reoffend. And we don't really see that same pattern among sex offenders. So I don't think that we're going to necessarily relax any of the policies that we have in place. One sex crime is a terrible thing to have happen. It's one crime too many. So I just don't really think that we're going to see society relax its assumptions about sex offenders based on this information specifically.
Erica, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Erica Schmidt, one of the co-authors of the Justice Department study on the recidivism rate among sex offenders.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up.
Expecting huge protests, President Bush prepares to head to London. Security measures are huge, but Queen Elizabeth nixes a plan to have a Black Hawk helicopter hover over Buckingham Palace.
And music from two legendary jazz bassists, Miroslav Vitus and the late Jaco Pastorius.
When Jaco appeared with this tune on his first solo album, I would guess that bass players especially all over the world gasped collectively.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. John Allen Muhammad has been convicted of all four counts against him, including capital murder. The Virginia Beach jury concluded that Muhammad terrorized the Washington, D.C. area during last year's sniper spree. More from Thelma Lebrecht.
The jury of seven women and five men have found Muhammad guilty on all four counts. They found him guilty of committing murder and the murder of Dean Myers last fall, and that is also alleged to be part of an act of terrorism. They also found him guilty in the killing of Myers and at least one other person last year. That also subjects him to the death penalty. Plus, the jurors also found him guilty of conspiracy. That means a charge of 1 to 10 years in prison and guilty of committing a felony with a firearm.
That's reporter Thelma Lebrecht. Jurors will now decide whether to impose the death penalty. Fellow suspect Lee Boyd Malvo is on trial separately for the killing of Linda Franklin at a Home Depot in Fells Church. He could also get the death penalty. A lawyer representing John Hinckley Jr. is asking a federal judge to let his client make unsupervised visits to see his parents, saying it's the next step in Hinckley's treatment. Hinckley shot President Reagan and three others in 1981 and has been at St. Elizabeth's Psychiatric Hospital since being acquitted by reason of insanity. Reagan's family and the government opposes unescorted trips, saying no one knows what Hinckley is thinking. The U.S. military in Saddam's hometown of Tikrit says it's sending out a message to insurgents. Lourdes Navarro reports.
The U.S. military in Tikrit paraded down the center of the city. Hundreds of troops riding in tanks and armored personnel carriers drove past residents in what the U.S. military commander there said was a warning to attackers that the resistance will be crushed. The show of force was backed up overnight by action. U.S. helicopters and tanks fired at suspected guerrilla positions there, destroying, according to the military, 15 suspected safe houses, 3 training camps, and 14 mortar firing points. 6 suspected Saddam loyalists were also killed and 21 arrested. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
The White House is warning congressional Democrats not to attempt to block a Medicare overhaul bill that's headed for a likely showdown this week. Top Democrats are angry over provisions that would subject Medicare to competition from private health plans. President Bush says he'll be actively pushing the bill. On Wall Street, midday, stocks are down. The Dow is down 93 points at 96.76. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush will dine with the Queen of England this week in the first formal state visit by an American president to Britain since Woodrow Wilson's in 1918. War was on everyone's mind then and will be this week, too. Bush's policies in Iraq make him wildly unpopular in Britain. His critics there call him the toxic Texan. and he travels overseas as the deadline for his domestic agenda approaches at home. Both a national energy policy and Medicare reform are up for votes in Congress this week, as lawmakers rush to end the year with the Thanksgiving recess by Friday. Quite a week shaping up. Here to discuss it are members of our D.C. roundtable. Sarah Fritz is Washington Bureau Chief of the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Robin.
And David Shribman, Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Hi, David.
Hi, Robin.
Boy, reading some of the British press online, President Bush is seen as checking in on his poodle, Prime Minister Tony Blair, when they meet this week. And that meeting, David, was first crafted last spring. It probably seemed like a good idea then.
Oh, it seemed like a good idea. The two words in everybody's mind, at least the White House's mind, were mission accomplished rather than mission unfinished, or some people would say mission undone. And so it's a very different setting politically than they might have contemplated when they made these arrangements.
Right. Robin, this really challenges the notion that this is an administration that is a public relations genius. There are two elements of this that are just dreadful for this president. One is, of course, his going to London and being stimulating all the anti-war protests over there. And number two, sort of taking refuge in Buckingham Palace and being photographed rubbing elbows with the royals can't help his sliding popularity here at home either.
Well, some say that that picture might come in handy in the election campaign.
I don't think so. There have been a lot of elections that have been won on criticizing Great Britain. There aren't a lot of elections that I can remember that have been run by cozying up to the royal family.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely going to be with his main ally in the war in Iraq. And let's go to that. In interviews yesterday, the president insisted he's not cutting and running in Iraq in deciding to move to reduce troops and to transfer power to the Iraqis sooner than had been expected. But what do people in Washington think about last week's new thinking about Iraq?
Well, two members of Congress have spoken out very forcefully, two well-respected members, John McCain and Joe Biden of Delaware, have spoken out very forcefully in favor of sending more troops to Iraq and getting the job done. And I think this will prompt more discussion of that.
Well, let's move to Congress. Congress is going to try to squeeze an entire year's worth of legislation into this week. It's taken a year for lawmakers to come up with a prescription drug bill. But, David, this Medicare bill would do a lot more than provide seniors with a drug benefit. And some Republicans are joining Democrats in protesting it.
Well, first of all, let's say this looks and sounds and smells an awful lot like cramming for finals. And it's not the most appealing sight either from inside or outside the Beltway. But the fact of the matter is, if there's one demand besides a peaceful resolution to the troubles in Iraq, if there's one demand in America today as we approach primaries, caucuses, and elections, it's that there'll be some resolution to the spiraling costs, particularly for seniors, but for everybody, really, but particularly for seniors, for prescription drugs. And so the pressure is on, and people are reading the fine print.
The Republicans really are counting on that sort of desire in the public mind to force Democrats to vote for this. This is not a bill that Democrats want to vote for because it would, as they say, privatize or begin to privatize Medicare. But the Republicans are saying to the Democrats, we dare you to vote against this.
Well, Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts says he doesn't think the bill stands a chance. His main complaint is what you just mentioned, Sarah, that too many seniors would move to private health plans, and that would leave the pool of very sick seniors on Medicare with skyrocketing premiums to try to hold up Medicare. Will he filibuster, David?
Well, it's possible, but everyone's eyes are on the election, and everybody's eyes are on the polls, and that is really the worst way to make policy, and it's the best way to make a mistake, and it's the best way to come up with some plan, Republican or Democrat, that will cost a lot more than even the critics say it will. So they had better be careful in these last couple of days.
By the way, how did the crafting of this bill work? We read that Democrats were actually locked out of meetings. Only two were invited in, and it was a Republican-crafted bill. How does that work?
Well, this is a peculiar process. Basically, the Republican leadership has spent the last two or three months negotiating with itself. And they announced an agreement over the weekend, but the agreement is really just between the leaders of the House and the Senate plus two Democrats. So we have yet to find out whether the rank-and-file Republicans in the House will go for this or whether the Democrats in the Senate will. And you know, I've talked to a lot of seniors in Florida about this. They think the benefit provided in this bill is pretty weak. At the same time, they would be disappointed if a bill didn't get passed.
Well, another item up for vote this week, the energy bill. The president's plan to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is eliminated from the new proposed bill. What's in that bill for both parties, David?
Well, for John Kerry and his presidential prospects, the notion that he was a stalwart there and stood and many months ago was able to make it clear that they can go this far but not far enough to drill in the Alaska wilderness is quite a coup. He hasn't really played with it. He hasn't really exploited it, but he probably ought to. And for the Republicans, they can argue that maybe some energy security and stability is on the way.
Mm. Well, either way, win or lose, it really is quite a week.
It is quite a week. It's going to be pretty busy around here.
It sure sounds like a lot of people are going to get an awful lot of long, long hours and very little sleep.
And David, does it seem strange that the president would be outside of the country on the week that two of his key pieces of legislation are up for grabs?
I don't think that's unusual. In fact, it may actually work to his advantage because often parties will say to the opposition, let's not embarrass the president while he's representing American interests abroad.
Mm. And Sarah, I'm not sure how much it's going to do for U.S.-British relations, the amount of security that the U.S. is bringing over with his visit. Apparently, Secret Service agents asked to have a Black Hawk helicopter hover over Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, this is not going to make us any friends in London. I don't think the Londoners are as used to the kind of intense security that now surrounds the President of the United States.
Well, thank you both.
You're quite welcome.
Well, thank you.
Sarah Fritz, Washington Bureau Chief of the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. David Tribman, Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Still to come, the legend and legacy of two jazz bassists with our jazz reviewer, James Isaacs.
You're listening to Here and Now. A Virginia jury has convicted John Allen Muhammad on all counts. After 6 hours of deliberation, the jury found the accused sniper guilty of two counts of capital murder, including one count that he terrorized the population, making Muhammad the first American tried and convicted under that new post-9/11 law. Attorney David Whiteleaf of Breakstone, Whiteleaf & Gluck in Boston joins us. He's also an analyst with Lawyers Weekly. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Robin.
Were there any surprises in today's verdict?
Oh, I don't think so. This was a case with overwhelming evidence in every respect, and it was just a question of getting through the trial.
And also of some interest to lawyers, I'm sure, because of this new post-9/11 terrorism law. Tell us about that.
Well, the terrorism law just adds another dimension to potential sentencing here. This is a capital crime, meaning they can have a death sentence under the Virginia law, even in existence before 9/11, and it looks like that's probably where the jury is going to be taking this.
And when do you think the sentencing might come, and what are the options?
Ordinarily, in a trial like this, you have a sentencing hearing afterwards. There will be additional evidence. The jury's already heard about the horror associated with all of these murders. They may see and hear additional evidence. They'll also hear from the victims in terms of how they've been affected. They can take all those things into consideration when doing the sentencing aspect of the trial.
Well, Muhammad's fellow suspect and accomplice, alleged accomplice, Lee Boyd Malvo, the 18-year-old, he's in a separate trial in nearby Chesapeake. What does Muhammad's verdict, what impact will that have, if any, on Lee Boyd Malvo's?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how well insulated that jury is from this verdict. Ordinarily, in a case that has this much publicity, an effort is made to sequester the jury. This has got to be disheartening news for the defense team in the Malvo trial. They do have a separate defense, which was not argued here, and that is that Lee Boyd Malvo was insane because he was indoctrinated by Muhammad.
And why wasn't Muhammad ever declared insane?
It beats me. You know, it may be just the quality of the statements he was making when he was first arrested. It's a tactical decision. The insanity defense is a very, very difficult defense to mount and to win. He didn't have a very good chances. Must have been the assessment of his attorneys right from the get-go.
Well, and remember that, as you do, he began by defending himself pitifully, and this is the now infamous moment where he told some police on the stand, "You weren't there, and I was," putting himself at the scene of the crime he was accused of.
That was a horrible mistake. He had attorneys there to assist him. I can only imagine how badly they must have felt at that point to have such a damning admission come out from the defendant acting as his own lawyer.
We just have a few seconds, but the jury just began deliberating this case on Friday. I mean, was there any sense that anything else might have happened?
Oh, I don't think so. There was physical evidence. There was circumstantial evidence. There was eyewitness evidence. There was DNA evidence. There wasn't anything missing from the prosecution to this case.
Yes, and now John Muhammad guilty on all four counts. I'm David Whiteleaf. Thank you.
Thank you.
Legal analyst David Whiteleaf of Breakstone, Whiteleaf & Gluck in Boston. David's also an analyst with Lawyers Weekly.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Legendary jazz bassist Milt Hinton once said, "The bassist is the atlas of a jazz band because he carries the rest of the band on his shoulders." Well, Jaco Pastorius and Miroslav Vitus are two jazz bassists who carried the jazz groove in the last half of the 20th century and into this new millennium. Here and Now's jazz aficionado, James Isaacs, joins me in the studio now to talk about two great bass players, Jaco and Miroslav. Hi, James.
How are you doing, Bill?
James, I'm doing fine. Thanks for coming in. There are two new CDs out. First, a CD called A Tribute to Jaco Pastorius, and a Miroslav Vitus CD called Universal Syncopations. Why don't we start with Jaco Pastorius, James, and tell me a bit about him.
Well, Jaco Pastorius, born 1951, died, unfortunately, a terrible death in 1987, was beaten to death by a bouncer outside a nightclub.
He was killed in a brawl, or?
Yeah, Jaco had fallen on hard times. He was bipolar, suffered from manic depressive illness, and he exacerbated that with copious amounts of drugs and alcohol, I understand. And one evening in September 1987, I guess he mouthed off to a bouncer outside a club, and 9 days later, after being in a coma, he died.
What he left behind is some amazing music.
Tremendous.
Let's hear Jaco Pastorius. This is a song called Donna Lee from his very first solo CD, which came out in 1976.
Okay, well, first of all, Bill, Donna Lee is not Jaco's composition. It is Charlie Parker's very challenging bebop classic. When Jaco appeared with this tune on his first solo album, the title of which is simply Jaco Pastorius, I would guess that bass players especially all over the world gasped collectively to hear that kind of brilliance, that kind of articulation of the notes, that kind of drive, that kind of tone, that swagger, and to play it with this degree of sophistication and phrasing on the fretless electric bass. Well, Jaco, go ahead, do your thing. Yeah,
no
the triplet
frets.
Phrasing there, especially, and the glissandi, man.
Jaco Pastorius, Donna Lee. Let's move on, James, to this tribute CD. Tell me about the collection.
This is a project. It's a 14-piece band recorded in Miami in March of this year, I think March and April of this year. The band leader is a guy called Peter Graves, and when Jaco was very young, he played with Peter Graves' show band at a club in Fort Lauderdale called Bachelors 3. When I say show band, big-name artists of all kinds came in, ranging from Charo to Mel Torme, for example. So with this big band, this project, which is new on the Heads Up label, the conductor Peter Graves, and in most cases on this album, the arranger Larry Warlow, who knew Jaco when, they enlisted the services of 10 wonderful bassists. We're going to start with a tune featuring Victor Wooten, and maybe you know the band with which Victor Wooten plays most of the time, Bella Fleck and the Flecktones.
Yeah, yeah. Which, of course, Jaco. Is bluegrass.
Yeah, well, it's sort of space jazz bluegrass.
Space jazz,
you know.
Bluegrass.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when that tune, which is called Teen Town, written by Jaco, originally appeared on Weather Report's album Heavy Weather, I think that's the one, Jaco not only played the bass solo, he played the drums behind himself. He was a great drummer.
Let's go straight to another Jaco cut. How about punk jazz?
Okay, punk jazz shows the beauty of his orchestral voicings. I would guess that he was influenced, at least in part, by one of the great masters of orchestral voicing, Gil Evans. Punk jazz, and in this case, the bassist featured is Richard Bono.
The pulse of this Jaco Pastorius tribute album, just fantastic. Let's move on, though, to another great jazz bassist and composer, mm-hmm. Miroslav Vitus. He's got a new CD called Universal Syncopations. Now, how's it different from Jaco?
Well, for one thing, Miroslav Vitus plays the double bass, now known as the acoustic bass. Jaco was the fretless electric bass master, so there's a big difference right there. Yeah. Miroslav Vitus, who is from Prague, Czechoslovakia, and is just about to turn 56 years old, Vitus is interested, I would say, primarily in the free bop jazz of the late 60s and into the 70s, music that has been informed by the Miles Davis band of the 60s, but it's open-ended. And the thing about this album, Universal Syncopations, is that one never quite knows where Vitus's original compositions end and the improvisations begin.
Let's hear a cut, Univoyage.
Mm-hmm.
Univoyage by jazz bassist Miroslav Vitus and some other amazing players.
The guys on this album, all leaders, all very renowned in their own right. The saxophonist is Jan Garbarek, who, like Vitus, is European. Garbarek is from Norway. The pianist is Chick Corea. The bassist is Vitus. The drummer is Jack DeJohnette. And on guitar, John McLaughlin. So everyone check their egos at the door.
Yeah, not a bad collection.
Fantastic, yeah.
Let's hear another track. It's called Tramp Blues.
And it's probably the most, in big quotation marks here, traditional of all of the music within Universal Syncopations. It is a blues. Jan Garbarek is not known as a heavy blues player.
No, he's very New Agey, really.
Well, I don't know if I'd go quite with that, but he's a guy who definitely came up with his own approach. Let's put it this way. He'll never be confused with Sonny Rollins. I'm not putting him down at all because he has his own style, his own unique approach.
Tramp Blues, that loose kind of swing feeling on this Miroslav Vitus album.
Yeah, the
again,
call and response thing. Too.
Yeah, and compared to that hard driving, solid line of Jaco Pastorius.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a little short on time, James. Just one more cut from Miroslav Vitus.
Well, why don't we go out with Bamboo Forest? Vitus plays an ostinato line, which is a short, repeated phrase behind Jan Garbarek. It's insistent and quite appealing, I think. Bamboo Forest, Miroslav Vitus.
Great stuff today, James. Thanks very much.
Yeah, these are two musicians who certainly deserve, well, I say this all the time, they're jazz musicians. By definition, they deserve wider recognition. But that's why I'm here, Bill.
You said it, and we're glad you came.
My pleasure.
As always. Here and Now's jazz aficionado, James Isaacs. For more information on jazz bassists Miroslav Vitus and Jaco Pastorius, check out our website at here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
We'll look at the many challenges awaiting Governor Schwarzenegger.
And what do the quirky rock band They Might Be Giants and Madonna now have in common? They both wrote a kid's book.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.